if it's not because it's about maintaining our ability to be American in the near term and long term.
Craig Jones, if you can respond to the CEO of Palantir.
Palantir has a long history of making serious tens of millions, billions of profit from what ultimately I see as killing people in faraway lands that are too easy not to care about. I think this latest endeavor is, as we've kind of started this AI arms race, it's been good to see at least Anthropic, you know, throw their hands up and say, we want some ethical parameters put on that. But even that, which seems to be, and meanwhile, as that whole controversy has been playing out, as you covered with the Trump administration, we see Sam Altman from OpenAI rush in and take the contract that Anthropic has ultimately dropped. Huge profits. There are huge, the DOD is a, Department of War is a huge customer for many Silicon Valley firms. We've seen Microsoft use their platforms for the Israeli targeting. Apparently, Microsoft are looking into that. We see Google AI analytics also used for Palantir and for US DOD contracts. This is huge money. And I think, you know, should the Silicon Valley community wake up to ultimately the consequences of the technologies which they're working on, and see their effects on the ground, which is where I work with the people who've lost entire families, who've had their homes destroyed, who've been displaced, who have, you know, had their legs blown off. There's this real disconnect between those tens of billions being made for profits of war and those people who suffer its consequences.
This is OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, who you mentioned, speaking at the India AI Impact Summit in New Delhi in February.
We don't yet know how to think about some superintelligence being aligned with dictators and totalitarian countries. We don't know how to think about countries using AI to fight new kinds of war with each other. We don't know how to think about when and whether countries are going to have to think about new forms of social contracts. But we think it's important to have more understanding and society-wide debate before we're all surprised.
So that's Sam Altman of OpenAI. And just quoting the Pentagon Secretary, Trump calls him the War Secretary, the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, at a briefing in the last days. Unlike so many of our traditional allies who wring their hands and clutch their pearls, hemming and hawing about the use of force, America, regardless of what international institutions say, is unleashing the most lethal and precise air power campaign in history. V-2s, fighters, drones, missiles, and, of course, classified effects, all on our terms with maximum authorities. No stupid rules of engagement, no nation-building quagmire, no democracy-building exercise, no politically correct wars. Craig Jones.
Those are two jarring statements. Sam Altman's, you know, ideas, I think in some, you know, in what he said, he's right. We don't know about this. We don't know about that, what the future holds. My view would be that because we don't know the potential dangers, risks and damages that these technologies brings, we should pause as societies, as companies, as nations, as leaders, to have a serious conversation about what kind of AI future we want, whether this is a world that we want to build. Meanwhile, Hegseth, the Department of War, in January released a statement, a whole program actually, called the AI Warfare Fighter Strategy, which some of the quote that you've just read comes from. And it talks about maximum lethality, as you say, out with the rules of engagement. This is a deliberate sidelining of the checks and balances, accountabilities for war, the firing of military lawyers, who are the community that I've worked with, who give legal advice to militaries. And just going ahead with it and saying explicitly, you know, just because we don't know how these technologies work, we need this first mover advantage. And it's that classic move fast and break things. And, you know, we don't care about the consequences. It's these are really worrying times and developments.
You've referred to the war lawyer several times. That's the title of your book. Explain what you mean and how they've been fired and sidelined.
So these military lawyers have been, you know, fighting alongside militaries for centuries. In fact, the U.S. Corps is the oldest law firm in America. And they do all kinds of things. But the thing that I've been interested in is they're giving advice to military commanders and decision makers for operations. So anytime a single target is struck in the last couple of decades, you would have a military lawyer present looking at things, doing what's called a proportionality calculation. So, okay, here's the military target. What's the risk of civilians? Should we go ahead? Should we pause? Are there certain measures we can take to avoid civilian casualties? And a host of other considerations. You know, one would be the girls' school. Is this a legitimate target or is this indeed a girls' school? So that's military necessity. And, you know, they've had a long history. And, you know, I worked with them. These are professional, serious people, educated at the best law school throughout America. They're also soldiers. Israel has its own version of them. And, you know, they've done credible work with militaries. And the Trump administration, one of the first acts that he does after he's sworn in his second term is to fire the heads of those legal units. So, you know, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force each have their own heads. He fired them. And then further down the ranks, he fired and replaced them with yes men. And beyond the firing and replacing, we are hearing from reporting and from some of my own contacts that the military lawyers are either just not being listened to when they raise objections, or, you know, they're becoming silent in these war rooms where these decisions are made. Because much like in the Trump administration, where his, you know, civilian and his advisors are around him, unless you say yes and go along with it, you're simply not welcome there, and you'll either be fired or not listened to. And so, again, you know, seriously worrying, especially when you put that alongside this simultaneous war on all these civilian casualty initiatives. So there was something called the Center of Excellence, which was to do with civilian protection. It's been a decade in the making. Lots of senior people in the U.S. administrations, from Obama to Biden through Trump term one, have been involved in that. And Trump, you know, presses control or delete on day one and gets rid of the civilian center because they're not interested in avoiding civilian casualties, which, you know, feels like we're harkening back to Vietnam or something.
Finally, Craig Jones, we just have a minute, but if you can explain this rift between Anthropic and the Pentagon, Anthropic saying its company could not be used for mass surveillance of Americans and for fully autonomous weapons, and then the Trump administration retaliating after they sued, President Trump ordering federal agencies to stop using Anthropic products, Pete Hegseth declaring the firm a supply chain risk. But then we hear that Claude, owned by Anthropic, is possibly used by Palantir in targeting this girls' school that killed well over 100 girls.
Yeah, there's lots to say here. One is that, you know, that seems like a disproportionate act when a military, when a company just, you know, exercises its right to disagree with what the government is doing. And, you know, I think the CEO at the time said, you know, disagreeing with the government is American as American pie. But the other thing is that this is infrastructure. I think some people think, you know, AI is just a tool, you know, it's something on your desk or it's something in the background, you just press delete. It's infrastructure that's embedded in the entire, you know, intelligence apparatus. And so therefore you can't just delete it. So hence why it's still used, hence why it might take up to 6 months to try and get some of Claude products out of the software. The other thing is, you know, it was good to see that ethical objection. It seems like the only, you know, moral stance which has been taken on these conversations in the AI war is certainly in Silicon Valley. I would just object to their objection on two principles. They're against mass surveillance of U.S. citizens only. They say nothing about the citizens around the world. And partly their objection to its use for lethality is a technical rather than moral objection. It's to say right now the algorithms are not quite good enough because they have this error rate, but they're not necessarily saying that they wouldn't go along with its use later on. So it's not that they're against lethality and killing per se, but that just technically the algorithms are not quite ready, and so they wanted to press pause. So there's lots to say about that, but it is a disproportionate act and response by the Trump administration, I think.
Craig Jones, I want to thank you for being with us, senior lecturer in political geography at Newcastle University, joining us from the UK, the author of The War Lawyers, United States, Israel, and Juridical Warfare, expert on modern warfare and aerial targeting, currently leading a research project on civilian casualties and war-related injury in Gaza and Iraq. We'll link to your piece in the conversation. Iran War Shows How AI Speeds Up Military Kill Chains. Coming up, The director of the National Counterterrorism Center's resigned over the war in Iran, magnifying a rift within the MAGA movement over the war. Stay with us.
I don't want to play this game no more. The world is changing. See the end draw near. It's a life of chaos and an age of fear. Is this the price we pay? Is this the price we pay?
To the new world. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran. Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it's clear we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby, unquote. Those are the words of Joe Kent, who resigned Tuesday as the director of the U.S. National Counterterrorism Center. Kent's the highest-ranking Trump official to resign over the Iran war. His resignation exposes a growing rift within the MAGA movement over Trump's foreign policy. Kent served in the Army Special Forces and as a CIA paramilitary officer, twice ran for Congress and lost. As a candidate, Kent faced widespread scrutiny for his ties to the far right, including Nick Fuentes, who once said, "Hitler was awesome. Hitler was right," unquote. Kent had acknowledged Fuentes took part in a call to help him broaden his campaign's social media outreach. During his 2022 election bid for Congress, Kent hired a member of the far-right Proud Boys as a consultant. Kent has also accused the FBI of orchestrating the January 6th insurrection. Last year, President Trump selected Kent to head the National Counterterrorism Center. The Senate confirmed him last July. The Southern Poverty Law Center had urged senators to reject Kent, citing what they called his associations with white nationalists, violent groups, and anti-democracy actors, unquote. On Tuesday, President Trump was questioned about Joe Kent's resignation.
The director of National Counterterrorism, Joe Kent, he just resigned today. He said he can't support your conflict with Iran. What's your reaction to that? And did you?
Well, I read his statement. I always thought he was a nice guy, but I always thought he was weak on security, very weak on security. I didn't know him well, but I thought he seemed like a pretty nice guy. But when I read his statement, I realized that it's a good thing that he's out because he said that Iran was not a threat. Iran was a threat. Every country realized what a threat Iran was. The question is whether or not they wanted to do something about it.
To talk more about Joe Kent's resignation from his position as director of National Counterterrorism Center, we're joined by another former government official who resigned over another war, Josh Paul, former State Department official who worked on arms deals. He resigned in 2023 to protest the push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its assault on Gaza. Now, Josh Paul is director at A New Policy, the lobbying organization he co-founded with fellow resignee Tariq Habash to press for a change in U.S. policy on Palestine and Israel. Josh, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of Joe Kent's resignation, the highest Trump administration official to quit so far.
Thank you, Amy. Good to join you. So I think it is a significant resignation in several ways. First of all, of course, on its face, you have here a very senior U.S. intelligence official who is resigning and saying essentially that the United States is at war, but we are not at war to support our own national interests. We are at war because we have been pushed to do so by a partner country, specifically by Israel. Of course, in saying that, he is not saying anything that Secretary of State Marco Rubio, did not himself say just days into this conflict. The difference is that Kent, and here perhaps his background as a military operator on the ground in special forces for covert operations, coming into the D.C. political scene, I think, you know, probably pretty strongly objects to, given his own experience and, of course, the loss of his own wife in a terrorist attack in 2018. The second important thing here is that Kent is, by my count, the 16th U.S. official in the last 3 years to resign over the U.S.-Israel relationship. That is a trend that now spans both the Biden and Trump administrations. Of course, Kent is the first to resign from the Trump administration and the most senior to resign from either administration. I think a third important factor here is the insight this gives us into the debate that is happening within the MAGA movement when it comes to the U.S.-Israel relationship. We know that there is a very visible, very vocal debate happening in the Democratic Party on that topic. It is clear that there is also a very vocal debate happening within the right wing of American politics. It is just less visible. And that's due to a number of factors, including, of course, President Trump's management of the political party that is the Republican Party. But I think what we see here is this really coming to the fore and perhaps a leading indicator of further breaks and shifts within the party on this issue to follow.
This is Joe Kent speaking in 2024 about U.S. policy towards Iran.
We have to stop making ourselves easy targets in the region. Our presence in the region actually makes us much, much more in an unsafe condition, and it gives Iran the ability to access us in a very, very easy way. Deprive Iran of targets, deprive Iran of funding, strengthen the Abraham Accords, let Israel take care of their own business.
Your response, Josh Pohl.
So Joe Kent certainly knows the threat that Iran posed to U.S. forces when they are in the Middle East, having been awarded the Bronze Star several times, including for actions in Iraq. I think his point here is that this is, again, you know, whatever threat Iran may pose within the region, it is not a threat to the United States. And the reason that we are currently engaged in this is in great part because of our presence in the region that is there to protect Israel, in many cases from the consequences of its own actions. And we see that most vividly here. I think it is very clear that we would not be in this conflict if it were not for that presence, if it were not for that relationship. And I think at the end of the day, U.S. national security officials, intelligence officials, are there to put America's interests first.
It's interesting how the MAGA movement, the House Speaker, has just changed the rationale for attacking Iran, saying that this attack on Iran avoided a mass casualty event. And the question of whether this could provoke attacks on U.S. soil. It's interesting that Kent, this is in Mother Jones magazine, Trump's pick for counterterrorism, called for arresting BLM leaders as terrorists, who they were focusing on, people like Kent. He said, we need to treat Antifa and BLM like terrorist organizations. We need to use the tools of the federal government, the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, go after them like organized criminals and terrorists. This is how he spoke when Trump was supporting him. And of course, you have Tulsi Gabbard, who is head of national intelligence, and instead she is spending her time looking at how Trump actually won the election, currying favor with Trump. And she was down in Georgia when they were taking something like 700 boxes from the Georgia election office.
Yeah. And I mean, let's be clear. Joe Kent is very much within the core sort of the MAGA movement. At the same time as the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, and prior to that as chief of staff for the director of national intelligence, he and the NCTC have provided core support to the FBI's so-called 10-7 or post-October 7th task force, of course, engaged regularly in two-way intelligence sharing with Israel. And you heard his previous comments when it comes to, you know, advancing Israel's interests in the region and enabling Israel, to take that leadership on its own behalf rather than the U.S. exercising that leadership for it at cost to our own equities. So I think that there are a number of factors here. At the end of the day, I think what's clear is that Kent is someone who has, you know, I think was at the top of his career here, was only in the job for a year. I don't think went into that job with an intention of leaving it. But at the end of the day, saw the dreadful impact that we see now on the global economy, on the U.S. economy, on U.S. interests of this war that Prime Minister Netanyahu has dragged us into, and felt he had to stand up and speak.
You're the former director at the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department, where you worked for 11 years. Josh Paul, as we wrap up, what do you think Congress can do at this point? There is a lot of criticism, of course, of Congress members and senators of what Trump is doing with Iran right now, dropping these bunker buster bombs, for example, today. But what actually can they do?
So what they can do, of course, is much more than what they will do. What they can do is, of course, exercise their oversight. At some point in the coming weeks, there is going to be a very important vote when the administration comes forward with a funding request for the Iran war. If members of Congress mean what they say about not wanting to support this war and not believing we should be part of it, they should vote against that funding. So I think there are a number of steps Congress can take. There are also, I should note, emergency arms sales that the administration has put through in the last couple of weeks for Israel, some of which are coming out of U.S. stockpiles. Again, if members of Congress are serious about protecting U.S. military global leadership, then they should be voting against those sales that are coming out of critically needed U.S. stocks. So there are a number of things Congress can do. I think the question remains to be seen of whether they will do those things.
Josh Paul, veteran State Department official, resigned in 2023 to protest the push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its assault on Gaza, now director at a new policy lobbying group he co-founded with a fellow resignee to press for a change in U.S. policy on Palestine-Israel. Coming up, we look at the Trump administration's escalating attacks on the press as President Trump threatens to charge journalists, news outlets, with treason. Treason is punishable by death. Stay with us. By Sebastian Zawadzki. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's escalating threats against media outlets. In a post Sunday, President Trump said news organizations should face treason charges for disseminating false information. FCC Chair Brendan Carr has also threatened to revoke broadcasters' licenses over their coverage of the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran. Carr wrote online, quote, broadcasters that are running hoaxes and news distortions, also known as the fake news, have a chance now to correct course before their license renewals come up, unquote. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut blasted Carr, saying, this is the federal government telling news stations to provide favorable coverage of the war or their licenses will be pulled. A truly extraordinary moment. We aren't on the verge of a totalitarian takeover. We're in the middle of it, Senator Murphy said. This all comes as allies of President Trump consolidate their control over several major media outlets. Paramount Skydance poised to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery, which includes CNN and HBO. Paramount's CEO is David Ellison, the son of Larry Ellison, a close Trump ally. Last week, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth made this comment about CNN.
Or more fake news from CNN. Reports that the Trump administration underestimated the Iran war's impact on the Strait of Hormuz. Patently ridiculous, of course. For decades, Iran has threatened shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. This is always what they do, hold the Strait hostage. CNN doesn't think we thought of that. It's a fundamentally unserious report. The sooner David Ellison takes over that network, the better.
At the Oscars Sunday, late night host Jimmy Kimmel made this remark about CBS, which is now owned by Paramount.
We hear a lot about courage at shows like this, but telling a story that could get you killed for telling it is real courage. As you know, there are some countries whose leaders don't support free speech. I'm not at liberty to say which. Let's just leave it at North Korea and CBS.
We're joined now by Craig Aaron, co-CEO of Free Press and Free Press Action, not to be confused with Barry Weiss's The Free Press, which is now owned by Paramount, and she's head of CBS News. His news article is headlined, "Warmongers Come for the Media." Craig, talk about the significance of this moment. Senator Murphy says this: we're not on the precipice or the edge of totalitarianism. We're in the midst of it.
Thank you, Amy. Yeah, this is a very clear abuse of power. The idea that the chairman of the FCC would be, you know, threatening broadcasters with losing licenses for not echoing Trump administration propaganda. The idea that the defense secretary is out there cheering on a mega merger so that Trump cronies can be put in charge of the media to get more favorable coverage. We really haven't seen anything like this in recent memory, and it has been going on throughout the Trump administration, just a complete abuse of power by FCC Chairman Carr, performing really for an audience of one that is Donald Trump, jumping on his every utterance to saber rattle, to threaten broadcasters. And really, the threat is the point. They want these companies to be afraid. They want them to change, and they are sadly too often willing to do it in order to push through mergers, in order to get special favors, in order to guarantee their other divisions big fat government contracts. They've shown a willingness from CBS on down to warp and alter coverage to make it more favorable to the Trump administration. And as we've seen, whether it's lawyers, universities, media companies, when the bullying works, you just get more and more bullying.
Craig Aaron, he's talking about threatening news organizations with treason. Presumably, this also means the journalists within them. It's extremely serious, because if you are convicted of treason, you face death. You have, for example, Hegseth responding to journalists covering the death of the service members in the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, saying that this is unfair to cover this. You have when a reporter asked President Trump on Air Force One to talk about the deaths, for example, of the six service members. He goes next. He doesn't want to answer this question, Craig.
Yeah, this is really unbelievable. You're talking about basic coverage of the most important and serious issues. And you have an administration that wants to hide and warp coverage of their own incompetence, of their own failings, of their own crimes, like these that you covered earlier in the program and the deaths of hundreds of school children. They don't want the U.S. media covering this story, and they are showing that they are willing to threaten the use of regulations, of government policy, of changing owners in order to push those media companies into silence, in order to have journalists question what stories are they going to cover, wonder if their bosses are going to back them up when they do serious reporting on the crimes of this administration, whether that's kidnapping people and sending them to other countries, whether that's launching a war. The most serious stories that we need the newsrooms with the biggest resources covering, the Trump administration is signaling, you better think twice. And unfortunately, the billionaire owners of these companies are signaling back, if you'll give us favors, if you'll give us mergers, we're willing to do your bidding. This works because
the CEOs have
backed off, and they're going to keep doing it until these media companies start standing up.
Craig Aaron, co-CEO of Free Press and Free Press Action. We'll link to your new article, "Warmongers Come for the Media." We'll be live streaming our 30th anniversary event at democracynow.org next Monday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Broadcasting on the Internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.